Well, good evening, everyone. Wonderful to see you all here. So this is our first Wednesday seminar, starting the practice period that began on the weekend with our weekend retreat. And the focus, as I think almost everybody here knows, is on the Chinese ancestors. And so we'll be almost every week picking up and looking at the teachings of one of our Chinese ancestors and seeing what they may have to tell us today. Kate will be away for a little bit. She's gone to visit her parents in Pennsylvania, so you're stuck with me for the next week and a half or so, but I'll try to keep you all entertained. In one sense, I suppose when we talk about the ancestors, we should begin with the Buddha, because that's where the traditional Chinese lineage actually begins. They trace everything back, kind of warm hand to warm hand, as they say in the Zen tradition, all the way back to the Buddha. But the starting point, really, is a monk named Bodhidharma. And you may have noticed the funny little red doll on the altar. That is a Japanese version, folk version of Bodhidharma. And I'll talk more about Bodhidharma and the legends and stories about him on Sunday. Bodhidharma, as we talked a little bit on the weekend about him, is a monk who came probably either from India or from somewhere in the northeast. We're not exactly sure where he came from. And really, it doesn't make much sense to talk about India or China in the sense that we think of it, because historically, India was never India. It was a group of kingdoms that sometimes many, sometimes fewer. And China as well, over the period of time that the people we call the Han Chinese lived there, China swelled and contracted. So please, as we use these words, remember they changed greatly over time. So as I said on Sunday, I'll talk a little bit more about these mythic beginnings of Bodhidharma, because there's quite a few legends about him. But he plays a really important role in the establishment of Zen. Now, as Kate discussed at the practice period opening retreat, myths and stories are just as important as historical facts. Myths and stories are just as important. In fact, I would say maybe they're even more important. Because they shed light on what our Chinese ancestors took as most important in the Zen practice. These myths are very powerful. And really, we have very few historical facts about the formation of Zen in China. Much more in the past 30 years, 20 to 30 years, as translations have been done about documents found in these caves, the Denghuang Caves. But tonight, we're going to read and consider what many scholars have noted as the very first Zen text in China. And I'm going to use the word Zen rather than the Chinese word Chan. Chan comes from the Sanskrit, dhyana, meaning meditation, and Zen is simply the Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese word. So I'm just going to use Zen, since that's what most of us here are familiar with. So this text, which I'm going to pass out in just a moment, is called Two Entrances and Four Practices. It was written probably in the 6th century, in the Common Era, and the Zen tradition attributes this to Bodhidharma. This is the essence teaching, the essential teaching of Bodhidharma. And when I was thinking about what we're doing this practice period, I thought, maybe we should start with this short text. It's only about a page long. Not only because it's the first recognized Zen text, but also because we can really contrast it with what we're going to hear next week and the weeks after. See how Zen practice and Zen teaching, the Zen style, kind of evolved a little bit. It gives us a sense of the changes that happened within this tradition. And while we may notice, though, I think quite a few differences between this text and later writings, I think you'll see and agree that the heart of the teachings remains the same. The Dharma, as we study it and receive it in the very early text, the text, you know, the Pali text, the Sanskrit text that were written in India, are very didactic, very logical. With each practice and each stage kind of carefully laid out. And usually in these early texts, it's the Buddha who's speaking, right? The Buddha said, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end, all of those who've been listening to the Buddha's teachings suddenly awaken to the truth. Unfortunately, it doesn't translate into written form because, you know, no matter how many times you read it, I don't seem to awaken to the truth. But anyway, I guess the power of the live voice, the Buddha speaking there, taught people. So, I made 21 copies, and I think we're about 28 people or so. So a few people will have to share. But if you could start passing these out, and a few people, if you would just kind of share together. We're going to read this together. As I mentioned, this is considered to be the first Zen text by scholars and also within the tradition itself. This is the beginning of the amazing collection of Zen literature and Zen texts. So we'll just kind of read through it together, and I'll make comments after we read each of the different paragraphs. So could someone read paragraph 1 for us? Look.
Many roads lead to the path, but basically there are only two: reason, principle, and practice. To enter by reason means to realize the essence through instruction and to believe that all living things share the same true nature, which isn't apparent because it's shrouded by false sense, impressions, and delusion. Those who turn from delusion back to reality, who meditate on walls, the absence of self and other, the oneness of mortal and sage, and who remain unswayed even by written teachings, are in complete and unspoken agreement with reason. Without moving, without effort, they enter, we say, by reason or principle.
Right. Now, some translations have used the word reason, which is a little bit strange. Which I'll talk about in a moment, and other translations use principle, meaning the foundation of things, the essence of everything. So, according to this, the first road is to see things as they really are, and fully realizing that all living things share the same true nature. This is what the first opening of the text is telling us. Can we see this immediately? There's an expression in Japanese, to hear one and understand ten. To hear one and understand ten. So this is what Bodhidharma is kind of pointing to. There are few people who will hear something and suddenly the light bulb goes on. And we're going to hear about one of these experiences next Wednesday when I talk about the sixth patriarch, Huainan. He was a wood carrier, uneducated, and one day he heard someone reciting the Diamond Sutra, and immediately he woke up. Lucky guy. So in this text, unlike the careful, logical probing that we're familiar with in the West about reasoning, right? Mathematical reasoning, the philosophical reasoning, this kind of reasoning here refers to an intuitive understanding that arises unexpectedly as a kind of sudden knowing, a visceral experience of, oh, suddenly you realize something. And here also we have the word to believe. And we are encouraged to believe, but this belief is a belief based on personal experience. And actually, when I looked at the Chinese, a better translation, I think, would be trust. Trust. And this trust is the kind of trust, I would say, we have trust in our doctor or our dentist, right? So Tony wouldn't come to me when he has a toothache. He has no trust in me about that. And he'd be very wise to not trust me. Instead, he'd go to his dentist. And why? Because he's gone to a dentist before, and the dentist fixed it. You know, the dentist has a diploma on the wall, and there's a certain kind of trust just in seeing the paper on the wall, etc., right? We have a sense of trust. It wouldn't say belief. So this sense of trust is also what Bodhidharma is indicating here. We develop and create a sense of trust in our practice. So far, okay? So the human problem, according to Bodhidharma, is our grasping at sensations and our confusion, that these mislead us. And the way through our confusion and our grasping is, as it says here, meditation on walls, which is what we do, right? At least the ones who get to sit against the wall get to do that. In other words, to engage in disciplined meditative practice of simply silently facing the wall, which means silently facing ourselves. And when we face ourselves silently, we let go of our judgments, our evaluations, our concepts, our stories. And as we do that, naturally, we open into a partnership with all things, which has always been there. But we're distracted. We open to the oneness of the world. And I think we've all experienced this to some extent. Sometimes, you know, when you're out on a hike and everything gradually drops away, on a camping trip, on a lake. For many people, it's in nature. For some people, it's in music. Deeply listening to music and just everything drops away. For me, it's been food. A really good curry. Everything drops away. So that's the first entrance, that the Bodhidharma is talking about. And this is one that a few people experience suddenly. I had a number of years ago, a young man came to see me. This is at our old place on Fraser Street. And he'd had a very strong experience. He was out walking and had looked up at a power pylon, like one of those big power lines. And something happened at that point. And it was very strong for him and a little bit disturbing. And he came to see me. First time he'd come to the Zendo. And I said, okay, describe the experience. He described it and he said, am I enlightened? And I said, do you feel enlightened right now? He said, no. I said, I think there's a little more work to do, but you had a really powerful experience. Okay. So the second entrance is divided into four practices that outline specific and practical advice about how one can live the Buddha Dharma. And really, when you look at these, I think they echo the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. So let's have a look at those. And would someone read? Good. Brothers, do you want to read the next? Yeah.
To enter by practice refers to four all-inclusive practices: suffering injustice, adapting to conditions, seeking nothing, and practicing the Dharma. First, suffering and justice. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves, in countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manner of existence, often angry, without cause, and guilty of numberless transgressions.
Good. Why don't you read three as well, since it's kind of connected. Why don't you just go ahead and read that one?
Now, though I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor men can foresee when an evil deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. The sutras say, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset because it makes sense. With such understanding, you're in harmony with reason, and by suffering injustice, you enter the path.
Mm. So this may be a little challenging for us. The Bodhidharma here, I think, gives us a way to patiently endure our suffering, but acknowledging that suffering is the result of various causes and conditions. In other words, our suffering is not necessarily our own fault, and indeed, perhaps not our fault at all, but all the various causes and conditions that have shaped our life in various ways. But he goes on to say that the very adversity that you experience may be the catalyst that puts your feet on the path. Right? I mean, not many people come here when life is sweet. At least, not at first. That's not what brings people here, right? Past deeds in this passage are suggested as the cause of unwarranted suffering. But whether or not we accept the possibility of past lives, I think the key for us here is that Bodhidharma calls upon us to acknowledge our own behavior, whether that is deliberate or just inadvertent, to really see our own behavior in the mess of our life, and to meet our suffering with an open heart. In other words, Bodhidharma calls upon us to remain upright as we face the challenges of our life. I think he's pointing out here, when we feel we're the victim, we're not remaining upright. Yes, suffering. Yes, pain. Yes, this is horrible. This feels terrible. This is not what I would choose. And yet, can I be upright in the midst of this? See it and step forward. See it and go forward. There is little benefit in railing against the injustices of our life. We need to see the injustice, see the pain, and then decide, now what? Now, how do I step forward from here? And Bodhidharma in this passage reminds us that without discomfort, without suffering, how then will we turn away from the trivial aspects of our life? How will we recognize the harm that has been caused by our own greed, anger, and other afflictive emotions? This, you know, reminds me of the First Noble Truth, really, to see clearly the nature of our discomfort, the nature of our suffering. And when we see clearly, that gives us a chance to remain upright in the midst of it and go forward. This echoes a passage from, or brings to mind a passage from the Dhammapada, Are you familiar with the Dhammapada? It's a collection of short verses, quotes, spoken by the Buddha. It's a lovely little text to carry around. Studied a lot in the Theravadan tradition today. So here's a quote from the Dhammapada. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. Those who harbor such thoughts do not still the hatred in their heart. He abused me, he struck me, he overpowered me, he robbed me. Those who do not harbor such thoughts still the hatred in their hearts. Harbor a thought. In this sense, the harbor a thought means to nurture it, to nurse it along, to dwell on it. Something I think almost everyone does. But if we do that, then the anger or bitterness, this translation says hatred, whatever we're feeling, will never go away. It will just will never go away. How can we release those thoughts? Okay, let's go on to the next paragraph here.
Second, adapting to conditions, as mortals, we're ruled by conditions, not by ourselves. All the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. If we should be blessed by some great reward, such as fame or fortune, it's the fruit of a seed planted by us in the past. When conditions change, it ends. Why delight in its existence? But while success and failure depend on conditions, the mind neither waxes nor wanes. Those who remain unmoved by the wind of joy silently follow the path.
Mm-hmm. I should mention, in the Chinese, words like us, etc., are not there. So the translator has put these in, of course, to make it clear in English. So it just basically said seeds planted in the past. So it leaves it a little more open to interpretation. So here Bodhidharma reminds us that all things are the result of causes and conditions. Almost everything in our life and in our past has been beyond our control. And practice allows us to see things as they really are, as kind of an ongoing process, ongoing happenings. We are ruled by conditions. Now, ruled may seem a little harsh, but we are certainly shaped by our conditions. Everything, really. How little we have actually done by ourselves. Who taught you how to speak English or another language? Who taught you to play a musical instrument? Who taught you how to read? How to use chopsticks? Everything. Almost everything that has shaped us that we think we're good at or skilled at, you know, yes, we contributed, but it was through the grace or the influence of those who came before us. In the West, we don't pay much attention to lineage. In Asia, much more focus is on lineage. And I think we could use a little bit more, a kind of gratitude for all that has come before us. It goes all the way back. And it is warm hand to warm hand. The joys and sorrows of this life are also part of the great river of change, Bodhidharma reminds us. We need to accept impermanence of all things. And when we can do this, then we rest in a kind of equanimity. And equanimity doesn't mean kind of a bland placidness. Equanimity means the ability to let go and not be pushed and pulled when something wonderful happens or something painful happens. We remain steady and respond appropriately to the event. The Japanese poet Ryokan, one of David's favorite poets, I think, right? Ryokan wrote this. This is back in the 1800s. He wrote, "When we meet a disaster, the best way to avoid disaster is just to meet it." When the time to die has come, the best way to meet death is just to meet it. Haven't you had that experience before, the great disaster, you know, that your mind has created, and then when you just meet it, the disastrousness of it just vanishes, right? That terrible experience of going, you know, to say your professor, you haven't written the essay yet, and you know he's just going to fail you, and the story gets worse and worse, and then maybe your professor says, next week, I'll take 10% off. Not so bad. When we meet a disaster, the best way to avoid disaster is just to meet it. I was reading some stories about Fukushima the other day. I picked up a book, the great tsunami earthquake disaster that happened there. And it was a kind of a book of interviews. And terrible, painful things happened. But one thing that was mentioned there, that in the midst of the disaster, you don't think about it. You just respond. Pulling children up to higher ground, getting people out of buildings. There's no thought. It's just responding to it. So this is what Bodhidharma is encouraging us to practice. So let's go on to paragraph 5. Virginia?
This world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always, in a word, craving. But the wise wake up. They choose reason over custom. They fix their minds on the sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. All phenomena are empty. They contain nothing worth desiring. Calamity forever alternates with prosperity. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to suffer. Does anyone with a body know peace? The sutra says, to have craving entails suffering. To be without craving means joy. Understand clearly that to be without craving is equivalent to the true practice of the path.
Mm. No, that's good. That's good. Thank you. So this teaching, I think, is pretty clear. The Bodhidharma tells us that we can never be satisfied by what we lack or desire. In part because there is no you really there. And there's no really separate object to crave. But we're kind of caught in thinking, if I can just get a little bit more, or a lot more, then I'll be happy. I read somewhere, there's no point in getting more than $500 million in life because you can't spend it. And yet, there's no stopping, right? People, Warren Buffett and people like that, just can't stop. They have to go in for the billions. This is really the fundamental teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha. What are you hanging on to? What do you need to be happy? What is your mind telling you you need this to be happy? But I'd like to suggest maybe when that craving arises, you should ask yourself, when do I experience joy? When do I experience joy? To have a body is to suffer, Bodhidharma writes. Well, as a person who is aging, I can verify that. But to be without craving means joy, he writes. Please investigate this. When do you experience joy in your life? Okay, next one. Okay, Ben.
Fourth, practicing the Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist. The sutras say, the Dharma includes no being because it's free from the impurity of being. And the Dharma includes no self because it's free from the impurity of self. Those wise enough to believe and understand these truths are bound to practice according to the Dharma. And since that which is real includes nothing worth begrudging, they give their body, life, and property in charity without regret, without the vanity of giver, gift, or recipient, and without bias or attachment. And to eliminate impurity, they teach others, but without becoming attached to form. Thus, through their own practice, they're able to help others and glorify the way of enlightenment. And as with charity, they also practice the other virtues. But while practicing the six virtues to eliminate delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what's meant by practicing the Dharma.
So here, Bodhidharma is encouraging us to put the Dharma that we know to practice, to give it life, to put into actions the truths of emptiness, of interdependence, that everything is connected to everything else, and of non-self, the kind of question, the kind of endless craving that goes on, trying to protect what we consider to be mine or me. And when we live this way, the qualities of the bodhisattva naturally arise. Right? Bodhisattva is a being who works for the benefit of others, not entering into nirvana, traditionally as it goes, until everyone else has entered nirvana first. But the key practice of the bodhisattva are the virtues that I listed here: generosity, morality, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. These are known as the six paramitas. We'll be talking about them, I'm sure, again before long. But notice, and I think this is really key, this text ends with a really resonating Zen view, that this practice is not a matter of getting some kind of goal or reward or outcome or merit. That's not why we practice. It simply offers the profound simplicity that this moment, here and now, is a very expression of our awakening. That's what he means. They practice nothing at all. They're not trying to be generous, trying to practice morality, trying to make great effort. Because then you, there's the good bodhisattva. This is not so good bodhisattva over here. Right? You know, did you get an A or an A minus in your bodhisattva practice? They're saying, but they don't practice nothing at all. It is the expression of their life. The expression of their awakening. Okay, I'm going to pause here.